only for drakes and ducklings, but for himself. The approach of his middle years, the winds blowing is from an untraveled north. 'Tis on their way back east for the last time that the duck learns to hold perfectly still in the air, at any altitude, and remain there, whilst the earth spins beneath her. She understands that she may now shift north or south to any latitude she likes, without being restricted any more to the line and its visto. But she is curious about where else the parallel goes. She ascends one evening after mass, and as the party, with their tents, all go rolling away into the shadows, they in their turn watch her, poised above the last lit meridian, recede over the horizon and vanish. Next morning, here she comes roaring in at well over 700 miles per hour, coasting to a smooth stop and settling upon the Cook tent's peak with not a feather out of place. "Interesting planet," is her comment. "I have been o'er the foot of the Italian boot, close by Bukhara and Samarkand. I can't wait to do the equator. Ye have tapped into but 5 degrees of 360. 20 minutes of a day it would cause you astonishment and distress to learn of your minor, though morally problematic, part in." "A global scheme. I knew it," Dixon beginning to scream. "What did I tell thee?" "Get a grip on yourself, man," mutters Mason. "What happened to we're men of science?" "And men of science," cries Dixon, "may be but the simple tools of others, with no more idea of what they are about than a hammer knows of a house." "Ah," sighs Euphrenia, "all too true. The life of an automaton cannot, however conceived, strike anyone as enviable." "Excuse us, aunt," ventures Depew, "but did we understand you to say—" "Don't get her started," Bree hisses. "Have you, aunt," Ethelmer, fiendishly pretending interest, "really shared the life of—" "Shared? Why, in my own student days, in far-off Paris, France, I was obliged to keep starvation off my sill by pretending to be an automaton oboe player. My manager, Signore Drivelli, actually, under the statutes of the two Sicilies, we were man and wife, not only charged admission, but also took bets on the side as to how long I could play between breaths." "Zabby," pleads Mr. Lespark, "speak with her about this sometime, could you please, it being your family?" "What was your best time?" asks Ethelmer. "Never went longer than 20 minutes or so, but I could have easily tootled on all night. The secret being to sneak charges of air in through your nose, using the cheeks as a plenum for storage, as 'tis in the bagpipes. The music written for oboe is notoriously lacking in places to breathe. The notes just keep coming, 16 or 32 of them every time you tap your foot. Not to mention the embellishments you're expected to put in yourself, for no extra fee, of course. The principal reason so many of us go insane being not from forcing air into a small mouthpiece, but in all the sneakery and diversion of attention required to keep blowing. In India, they understand how important the breath is, being indeed the soul in different form, and how dangerous it is to meddle unnaturally with the rhythms proper to it." As Dixon becomes possessed by the horizon, Hugh Crawford is seen to walk to and fro, shaking his head, presently muttering softly. Mason corners him behind a wagon. "Out with it, sir. Things are too precarious here for you to be concealing your opinions from me." "Not concealing, withholding, maybe." Mason, losing his composure, lunges for and attempts to strangle the guide. They slip and stagger in the newly fallen leaves. "Very well, Mason. Off. Off, attend me. This is a mountain dulcimer that I put together by hand once when there wasn't much else to do." And in a wild notescape, almost minor, almost Celtic, commences an uncommonly amazing hammering and plucking. When Dixon appears soothed enough, "Now I've seen Mr. Dixon's ailment before, yes, with trappers, with traders, with rangers and strangers, the Frenchies out there call it rapture de west, brother, sooner or later it's going to take ye. Away to the sunset, along with the rest. So 'tis hey, ye dirt farmers, I'm gone for the prairies, and over the mountains, and down to the sea. If I get back some day, though the world shine as morning, yet ever will sunsets be beckoning to me." But out under the moon, Chestnut Ridge and Cheat behind them, and Monongahela to cross, into an overture of meadow to the horizon, lowlands become to them a dream whilst under a spell, the way it gives back the light, the way it withholds its shadows, who might not come to believe in an eternal west, in a momentum that bears all away. Men are removed by it, and women from where they were, as if surrendered to a great current of westering. You will hear of gold cities, marble cities, men that fly, women that fight, fantastical creatures never dreamed in Europe. Something always to take and draw you that way. Mr. Crawford puffing meanwhile upon an Indian pipe, whose bowl, finely carved of soft stone by a Quebec Frenchman he had dealings with years ago, depicts a female head of classical beauty, her locks spilling beyond obsessiveness, all blackened with fire and grease, smoked out of for all those years, having held a thousand stems, from reeds stirred by the mists of Niagara to cane at the mouth of the Mississippi. You recall to me myself in my first days out here, up all night, going west by way of the stars. It's said some have a gift for it, like dowsing, and can run true bearings indefinitely under the most obscured of skies. Many of Colonel Byrd's companions running the line twixt Virginia and Carolina possessed the gift. When the party split, with half going round the Great Dismal and half right across, becoming detained in that Cypress purgatory for weeks, 'twas the westering certainty that got 'em through safe. I've even managed to keep my latitude for the odd few seconds, so I take an amateur's interest, and thus far, by my estimate, you are hardly the width of a pipe stem out. As to what draws Mr. Dixon, I don't mean to present it lightly. We say the westering's got him. And I also tell you this so you'll know that when, here Mason draws a sharp breath, something requires an unpremeditated cessation to the line, well, Mr. Dixon may not be inclined to stop. He wouldn't take a chance with his, but the guide has put a hand upon Mason's arm, motioning with his head as Dixon comes into view. He has been wandering among the tents and wagons, looking troubled, very tall and out of scale in the uncertain dinner-time light. By the time he's out of earshot again, it has occurred to Mason. You said what? An unpremeditated cessation. Is there something else I should know? There is, nor does it take long in coming. Mortality at last touches the expedition. William Baker and John Carpenter are killed by the fall of a single tree on September 17th, a Thursday. Is possible they signed up together and worked together. Their names are entered together in Mr. McLean's records. The next week, Carpenter's is entered by mistake, to be followed by a trailing line over to a row of zeros for days worked in the week. Mo must have forgot, so may the bookkeeper's page be haunted. A ghost entry, John Carpenter's soul lingering, William Baker's to appearance having moved on. This is a disaster. Mason curled as a dying leaf, disposed to give it all up. You agree, don't you, Jeremiah? You know it doesn't happen. It never happens that two are killed in the fall of a single tree. Their people have them. They'll be safe, too vexed and reassuring himself to see Mason's point. You were the one looking for a sign, weren't you? Well, there's your miserable sign. Why aren't you reading it? 'Twas a tall old chestnut. They set their wedges wrong, and then it fell where they hadn't guessed it would. What else, pray? Damned right, pray, snaps Mason. Somebody'd better around here. They sit in the tent, coffee growing cold, Mason waiting for the sector to arrive, Dixon waiting for Mason to burst forth with, well, what's the fucking use, really? To which Dixon will have to come up with an answer, and not take too much time, either, doing it. Geminity hath found a fleshless face. No second chance. 'Tis death that's won the race between the line in all its purity and what lay massed within the mortal tree. Timothy talks, The Line. No question, beyond cheat they move in a time and space, apt one instant to the next, to stretch or shrink. As a chain's length may, upon the clement page, pass little noticed, whilst in an ambuscade may reckon as perhaps all or nothing. When the sector arrives, they set up upon a bluff overlooking Monongahela and watch the culmination of stars in Lyra and Cygnus, correcting for seconds plus and minus of aberration, deviation, precession, and refraction, whilst in cabins nearby the wives of the new hired axemen gather, and those axemen who may come through and out the back to take White May's whiskey out of a tin cup. Soon as the party has stepped west of Monongahela, Indians of nations other than Iroquois begin showing up to have a look at them. The Delaware chief, Catfish, his lady and his nephew arrive in the first days of October, all dressed as Europeans might be, and confer apart with the Mohawks, exchanging strings of wampum with them. Stranger and native alike confess ignorance of Catfish's mission in these parts, far from his village, and as if disguised, in coat, waistcoat, breeches, and cocked hat. Looking for business is how Hugh Crawford translates it, adding, "It is usually best in these cases not to inquire too closely." A few miles further on west, 8 Senecas, going south to fight the Cherokees, come and stay over in camp, obtaining powder of Mo McLean along with some paint. "Materials of war, I'm not sure we can write these off," Mason cautiously suggests to him. The commissary glares, as if presented with an opening for some violence. "Well, they're southern Indians," he explains instead. "They are snakes down there, poisonous, no human feeling. Whereas these Seneca, well, they're our Indians. We live in, as off, the same forests. If we can help them along, it ever pays to have a friend or two out here, gents." And at the final station by Dunkard Creek, as Mason records in his memoranda for 1767, the venerable Prisquietum, prince of the Delawares and brother to their king, pays them a call, and is presently describing for them the great unbroken meadow of the West, whilst Indian visitors pass by in all directions, staring or amused, sometimes in drink as well, regardless of the hour, all figures relating to their daily ration of spirits having been negotiable since the party crossed Monongahela. "It's like Covent Garden on Saturday night," Mason grumbles. "What are we become? A show they all must see or lose credibility among whatever Indians have for fops? I ought to just go over and inform that old coot." "Mason, he's 86. And why should traffic not be brisk? These people freely travel an arrangement of high roads connected upon a scale continental that nothing we know of in North Britain can equal, making us little different from the strollers who work the inns along the coaching roads of more civilized lands. Can't speak for thee, but I rather welcome all this mixed society. Not as formal this way as it might become," swinging his head westward. "Heaven help us if we run out of whiskey. As it is, Moe's got distillers clear back the other side of Monongahela, working back shifts by the light of the moon, and wagons that do and don't make it through, all so that our guests here will be taken care of. Peace, merriment, take joy of thy rude hurricane, O. Give no thought to what may lie beyond thy moment's mean horizon. Bottom in denario vertit, but don't let that stop you. Allow me rather to assume as well thy own burden of worry, being a self-sacrificing gent in a curious sort of way. Eh, Mason, mind thy wig now, for these are all good lads. They drink but in moderation, no more riotously than in Wapping, I am sure. Now I am entirely sedate, thank ye. Safest things to act insane, of course, Mr. Crawford advises. How's that? We style it doing a Chapman. A trader by that name, captured near Fort Detroit at the time of Pontiac's rising, famously having escaped execution by feigning to be mad. These folk respect madness. To them, 'tis a holy state. As I told thee, Mason, nothing for thee to worry about. I noticed them stepping lightly round you. Hitherto, as if by conscious agreement, withdrawal into folly by the one surveyor would have unfailingly provoked an embrace of sobriety by the other. So, up till now, has the line been preserved, day to day, from frenzied impulse, as from reasoned reluctance, allowing it to proceed on its way unmolested. Here, as it draws to its last halt, if anywhere, might both gentlemen take joy of a brief holiday from reason. Yet, too busy, Mason insists, and far too cheerful for that, supposes Dixon. As the stars tell you where it is, you must cut your path. So do the land and its rivers tell us where our tracks must go. Yet the stars in their power, Mason's melancholia so advanced that he is not fully aware of sitting wrapped in a blanket arguing religion with a Mohawk warrior with whom he is scarcely upon intimate terms, that only the mightiest God may command, deserve at least the one small, respectful courtesy of allowing their line to cross, without a mark, your nation's own great path. Come, says Daniel. Eh? Dixon, looking up from his pipe. Come where? Says Mason. Out on the path. We'll take a turn down toward Virginia and back again. Am I in condition for this? Inquires Mason of no one in particular. And what of all these Catawbas I keep hearing about? Will we be allowed to smoke? Dixon wants to know. The Indian is gazing at them doubtfully. You must see what it is you believe you may cross so easily. Follow me, though I am not entirely pleased with my back to either of you. They proceed along Dunkard Creek, abandoning their short-term destinies to the possibly homicidal Indian. The forest life ever presenting mystery to them. Too much going on, night and day, behind every trunk, beneath every bush. How many new Pontiacs may even now be raising forces, planning assaults, perhaps in the market for a couple of English surveyors to style a casus belli and publicly torture before putting to death?
Yeah.
Yet isn't this man entirely vouched for by Sir William Johnson? Or actually said to be vouched for? Perhaps the first item of the neo-Pontiacal uprising would be to put Johnson to death. Perhaps this has already occurred. So busy are the astronomers with these apprehensions that they nearly miss their guide's hand signal to slow down and approach with caution what lies ahead. The moon has not yet risen. The Indian steps off the path, motioning to them to do the same. This is troubling. They've been this far up already. See what you nearly stepped on? He crouches and fleetly retrieves a long, slender, though not easily broken, sliver of something from the trail. Swamp cane. It doesn't grow up here. They gather and splinter it, catch and kill serpents, dip the points into the venom, set them in the trail aimed toward us. Having gathered as many of the deadly points as he can find, he bends close to a small patch of untraveled ground. Forgive me for what I must now beg you to bear at my hands. Carefully, he pushes each point into the earth till only bits of the blunt ends remain. These Catawbas, Mason falling increasingly short of perfect nonchalance, how close are they, I wonder? Whoever set these, they weren't more than two, and they were moving fast. The main body could be anywhere south of here. Would be useful to know how far south, Dixon supposes. He means, let us go on into sure ambuscado and death, Mason hastily. He's a bit, what do you people call it? Tapping his knob and twirling his finger beside it. Pray do not suppose all Englishmen to be quite so free of care. By the time we get anywhere to tell anyone, they'll be someplace else. We'd better go back. For now, say nothing more and try to move quietly. Mr. Barnes is troubled at the depth of the silence that reigns. No longer frets the intemperate jay, he mutters. Withal, the siskin chirpeth not. Captain, what the fuck is going on? At either end of the warrior path, the heat, the agitation, the increasing tension grow. Never in memory, they are assured by their Mohawk escort, have Iroquois and Catawba each wished so passionately the other's destruction. Any new day may bring the unavoidable descent. With Indians all round them, the warpath a-tremble with murderous hopes, its emptiness feeling more and more unnatural as the hours tick on into the end of day, as the latent blades of warriors press more closely upon the membrane that divides their subjunctive world from our numbered and dreamless indicative, apprehension rising, axemen deserting, the ghosts of 55 growing, hourly more sensible and sovereign, as unavenged fires foul the dusk, unanswered mortal cries travel the forests at the speed of wind. Ah, Christ! Besides west, where else are they heading, those few with the clarity to remain? They both dream of going on, unhindered, as the halt dream of running, the earthbound of flying. Rays of light appear from behind clouds, the faces of the bison upon close approach grow more human, unbearably so, as if just about to speak. Rivers run swifter and wider, till at last the party halts before one that mayn't be crossed, even by the sturdiest bateau, that for miles runs deeper than the height of a Conestoga wagon. Upon that final bank, an Indian will appear silently and lead the party past a forested bend to a great bridge, fashioned of iron, quite out of reach of British, or for that matter, French arts, soaring over to the far side, its highest part, whenever there are rain clouds, indeed lost to sight, constructed long ago by whatever advanced nation live upon the river's opposite side. May we cross? Asks Dixon. May we not cross? Asks Mason. Alas, replies the son of the forest, not yet, for to earn passage there is more you must do. Why show it to us at all? Wonders Dixon. If I did not, your great road through the trees would miss it. You move like wood borers inside a post in a great house, in the dark, eating and shitting, moving ever into the wood and away from your shit, with no idea at all what else lies without. In the forest, comments Mr. Crawford, everyone comes round in a circle sooner or later. One day, your foot comes down in your own shit. There, as the Indians say, is the first step upon the trail to wisdom. They wake. Chapter 70. At the moment of the interdiction, when their eyes at length meet, what they believe they once found aboard the Seahorse fails, this time, to appear. It is not a faltering on either man's part, or the mistaken impression of one, or any moral lapse. 'Tis a difference of opinion. Mason, stubborn, wishes to go on, believing that with Hugh Crawford's help he may negotiate for another 10 minutes of art. But Mason, they don't know what that is. We'll show them. Let them look through the instruments or something, or they can watch us writing. They don't want any of that. They want to know how to stop this great invisible thing that comes crawling straight on over their lands, devouring all in its path. Well, of course it's a living creature. 'Tis all of us, temporarily collected into an entity whose labors none could do alone. A tree-slaughtering animal, with no purpose but to continue creating forever a perfect corridor over the land. Its teeth of steel, its jaws, axemen, its life's blood, disbursement. And what of its intentions, beyond killing everything due west of it? Do you know? I don't either. Then, just tidying these thoughts up a bit, you're saying this line has a will to proceed westward? What else are these people supposed to believe? Haven't we been saying, within 100 blades all the day long, this is how far into your land we may strike, this is what we claim to westward? As you see what we may do to trees and how little we care, imagine how little we care for Indians and what we are prepared to do to you. That influence you may have felt along our line, that current strong as a river's, we command it. We might make through your nations an avenue of ruin, terrible as the path of a whirlwind. But those are threats we do not make. But might as well make. As the Indians wish, we must go no further. No, we must go on. For 11 days, from the 9th through the 19th of October, they linger beside Dunkard Creek, the Indians keeping their distance, looking to their weapons, as to their routes of withdrawal, whilst the white folk dispute. Some of the hands are back east of here, cutting the visto to breadth as autumn closes in, and everyone is eager to be away, for there are other tasks that claim each in the party, including the surveyors, who at some point exchange positions, with Dixon now for pushing on, razzle-dazzling their way among the Indians at least as far as Ohio. Cheers the ticket. Let them have more than their daily ration of spirits. They'll be sports. Wait, you think you'll be getting through on charm? Indians all the way up into the Six Nations and down to the Cherokees know about that coat. Many have their eye upon it, and you are but the minor inconvenience from which 'twill have to be removed. The Indians grow coy and sinister. The women stare openly, steadily amused. Mason and Dixon are allowed to cross the warpath and 3 more turnings of Dunkard Creek before they can climb to a ridgetop high enough to set up the sector. At last the Dodd men have reached their western terminus, at 233 miles, 13 chains, and 68 links from the post marked west. Dammy, we're only a few miles shy. A few, 40 miles. 'Tis easy country. We're over the last ridge. We're in the Ohio country. Mason has seen it from the top of Laurel Hill. The most delightful, pleasing view of the western plains the eye can behold. The paradise once denied him by the mills, now denied him by, he supposes, British American policy, ever devious. They decide to travel light and fast, not to take the sector nor any other instrument. Mustn't tie that river in just yet. Aye, let them all be free while they may. Mason is gothically depressive, as Dixon is westerningly manic. Dixon's head, like a needle forever 90 degrees out, though it wobbles some, remains true to perfect west, while Mason might as well be riding backwards, so often does he look behind, certain they are about to meet an abbreviation of Braddock's fate. Mason, withal, via the happenstances of God's whimsy, is riding Creeping Nick, the same crazy animal that threw him onto the Jersey ice. Departing at sundown, keeping their latitude as best they may by Polaris, growing more fearful with every mile, they travel through the night, trans-terminal America whirling by, smelling of wildflowers and silt, and immediate lobes of honeysuckle scent, apt to ambush the unwary nose, amid moonlight, owls, smears of nocturnal color somewhere off-center in the field of vision. They make it to the great river just at dawn, the rush of the water loud as the sea. Stunned by the beauty of it, they forget, they linger, they overstay all practical time, and are surprised by a party of Indians in elaborate paintwork. "Far from your tents, Redcoat." It is Catfish and his nephew and some friends who reluctantly lower their rifles. "Having a look at the river, sir," Dixon replies. "There are Catawba parties about, Mingos, Seneca. Good thing we saw you first. How'd you sneak out past Hendricks? He never sleeps." Mason sees it first, then, tipped by his frozen silence, Dixon. Catfish is packing a Lancaster rifle, slung in a scabbard upon his saddle, with an inverted pentacle upon the stock, unmistakable in the moonlight. Mason looks over on the possibility that Dixon has a plan, and sees Dixon already looking back at him upon the same deluded hope. "Actually," says Dixon, "we only just arrived, so it isn't as if we've seen the river, if that poses any sort of problem. And it certainly isn't as if we're planning to settle here." Catfish, with one huge hand, slides the rifle out and holds it up before him, noticing the stir loop as if for the first time. He smiles without mirth at the surveyors. "You think this is my rifle?" "No, I took this rifle from a white man I have wished to meet for a long time. He was a very bad man. White people hated him. Beautiful piece, isn't it?" "The sign on it has evil powers," Mason warns. "You should take a knife or something and pry it out." "What happened to its owner?" Dixon, with a look of unsuccessfully feigned innocence. The Delaware is delighted to share that information with them, pulling from a bag he carries a long lock of fair European hair, so freshly taken 'tis yet darkly adrip at one end with blood. "This very day, milords. Had you been earlier, you might have met." Either Mason or Dixon might reply, "We've met," yet neither does. "It didn't feel complete to me," Mason admits later. "I expected he yet lived, screaming about the woods, driven to revenge at any price, a monomaniac with a hole in the top of his head." "Looking for that rifle back," adds Dixon. Coming back, setting in the last marks, crossing Jennings Run, Little Allegheny, Wills Creek, Wills Creek Mountain, the road up to Bedford, Ebbets Creek, Ebbets Mountain, at all the highest points in the Visto, they put up cairns, as the ancient British lay builders and Dodd's men before them, as later the Romans, for purposes more legionary than commercial. The hands keep leaving, without notice. With those who stay, the astronomers transiting from weightless obs to earthly back-wrenching toil, the obs demand by way of expression, set posts every mile, these being large segments of tree, roughly squared, 12 by 12 inches, and 5 or sometimes 6 or 7 foot long. First the crew dig a deep post hole, put in the post, fill back the hole, tamping down the earth scientifically, one shovelful at a time, then bring more stone and earth to make a cone about the post, leaving perhaps 6 inches of it visible. That is the surveyor's estimate of the mark's longevity, though, of course, angles of repose vary. And withal, Mason and Dixon will bicker, by now, over anything. On November 5th, two things happen at once. The Visto is completed, and the Indians depart, as if, as long as a tree remained, so might they. At last, the axemen have cleared the Visto back to the post marking their last station of the year previous, east of which all lies clear, all the way back to Delaware. "There being one continued Visto," Mason writes in the journal, "opened in the true parallel from the intersection of the north line from the tangent point with the parallel to the ridge we left off at on the 9th of October last. Mr. Hugh Crawford with the Indians and all hands, except 13 kept to erect marks in the line, etc., left us in order to proceed home." The departing axemen roam about, peering at, poking, and buying blankets, kettles, milch cows, grindstones, anything Mo McLean thinks he may sell to lighten the load before the mountains, no offer too insulting. The venue is a protracted spectacle of sorrowful farewells, debts settled or evaded, whiskey jugs a-swing upon every index, and a squirrel stifata from the commissary tent without equal this side of the Allegheny Ridge. At length, the last of the farmers, new-bought pots and pans a-clank, goes riding off into a dusk rendered in copperplate gray and black, the hatching too crowded to allow for any reversal or return. Leaving gathered by the wagons, smoking pipes, gray with fatigue and winter skylight, Mr. Barnes, Cope, Rob Farlow, the McLeans, Tom Hines, Boggs Jr., John and Ezekiel Killo, and the others of that faithful corps who stayed across Monongahela to the Warrior Path and the westernmost ridge and back again. None of the hands is feeling that well. Dixon has been giving out opiated filters to all who would but gesture toward their noses. As Moe McLean is writing at furious speed, chits upon Philadelphia money boxes as if he'll never see the place again. So what's it matter? Suddenly, expenditures are above £100, then £200 per week. Fiscal insanity has visited the commissary tent. Sensing opportunity, farmers with goods to sell appear from horizons all swear have been empty for hours. The snow drives in relentlessly. From the 9th to the 19th of November, another 11-day spin, there is little in the field book, suggesting either a passage so difficult that there was no time for nightly entries, or events so blameworthy on all sides that they were omitted from the account. In fact, such was the level of engagement required to answer to the elements as to mark the line that there was no time for bad behavior. This is the gradient of days in which the party must work their way up to the Allegheny crest, hastening as they may, the early winter having caught them west of the mountains. Here lie the most difficult miles of the long traverse, this ascent out of Ohio and out of the west. Unsettled by the abrupt absence of Mohawks, with whom they have come to feel almost secure, as so seldom in this continent of hazard, the skies, night upon night, too clouded over for observations, both surveyors, cast into perplexity, drink and play whist for sums neither will ever see all in one place at the same time. The crew, meanwhile, deserting day upon day, their replacements taking ever more exorbitant wages. Yet whilst they bide in this realm of the penny foolish and pound idiotic, till the moment they must pass over the crest of the savage mountain, does there remain to them, contrary to reason, against the day, a measurable chance to turn, to go back out of no more than stubbornness, and somehow make all come right. For once over the summit, they will be long again to the east, to Chesapeake, two lords for whom interests less subjunctive must ever enjoy priority. Though they have lost their race with the first snows, yet they pray they may get all the cairns dug and piled before the ground freezes too hard. The snow is already a foot deep. Traces break, a wagon skids back down the slope on its side, the canvas bellying, the animals fearfully trying to fight clear, tent poles and spades a clatter, a lantern against the low-lit day, falling and smashing upon the ice, tiny trails of flame borne instantly away. Here are the last cadre, out in the uninterrupted visto, from a certain height, oddly verminous upon the pale ribboned unfolding, fairly out in the hundred-league current of Shaw, where every step is purchased with a further surrender of ignorance as to what they have finished, what they have left at their backs undone, what, measuring the degree of latitude next spring, they shall be newly complicit in. Though, if it takes them much longer to get over the ridge, even if they escape freezing solid, they may yet have journeyed further into terrestrial knowledge than will allow them to re-emerge without bargaining away too much for merely another return following another excursion, in a cycle belonging to some engine whose higher assembly, and indeed purpose, they are never, except from infrequent glimpses, quite able to make out. Turned in retreat eastward again, watched from cover at every step, with apprehensions, instead of lessening, rather mounting, ridge by ridge, the party feel the warrior path engrossing more of their sentimental horizon, even as it recedes into the west. Immediately upon the deaths of Baker and Carpenter, begin a string of mishaps between men and trees, some nearly lethal, none unconnected. Felling mates try to keep as close as they may, often conversing more in a day than they have in all the time since they teamed up. Spending precious minutes in daily rituals of protection, all pay tolls at the gate of sunrise, good but for the one day that must be got through. Mason and Dixon look in again at the rabbi of Prague, inquiring in particular after Timothy talks. He is mad, countrymen are soon explaining to them. What he now styles his golem does not exist. Mr. Talks looks on with a tolerant smile. Because he heard it speak the same words as God out of the burning bush, Tim nowadays imagines himself Moses, with a commission from God to bring another people out of captivity. Out of the city, declares Timothy Talks, where affliction ever reigns, must the golem deliver them, over Schuylkill, out of that American Egypt. You don't want to be going into Philadelphia, lad, they warn him, carrying folk off and so forth. Nor, particularly, confiding in too many of those sits about the golem now, for to many of them, the old knowledge is an evil they'll be as content to execute you for as lock you away. I am quite undeluded, the forest dithyrambist replies, as to the Philadelphians, before all the lawyers. Come, come, does no one recall? 'Tis only by the grace that some call luck that anyone can quite escape the muck, as e'er amongst wax and wigs and printer's ink seepeth the creeping sly suborner's stink. There he goes. So do ye summon it, Tim. We're on to that by now. It will protect me as it will protect them it sets free. 'Twas ne'er your creature to command, Tim. Just so, it is our guardian. Mason and Dixon, each revisiting the rabbi of Prague for his distinct reasons, attend this discussion closely. Dixon has already proposed offering Mr. Talks the protection of the party as far as Newark, near the tangent point. So long as he doesn't bring the golem, stipulates Mason. He brings the golem, well, what do they eat, for example? What are their sanitary requirements? How shall Mo McLean, who's already striking himself daily upon the pate with his own ledgers, find the additional resources? Yet mightn't we turn the creature to some useful work, say upon the Visto, pulling up the trees by their roots, clearing out all those unsightly stumps? The axeman would never hear of it. Next two-story house we came to, we'd both be taken upstairs and defenestrated. Nay, I know what you seek, the neighborhood of prodigy, the mobility awestruck, entry to saloons you have previously been unwelcome in, whilst Mason himself, of course, is angling quite a different stream. Here is a creature made of water and earth, clay, that is, and minerals, as if an Indian mound of the West, struck by lightning, had risen, stood, and newly awakened, with its vis fulgoris surging among all its precisely fashioned laminae, begun purposefully to walk. An American wonder, one's own witness of which might even be brought back across the cold sea to the true terminable world again. Mason can think of no way to ask the obvious question, as he did of the learned dog, and has been reluctant to of the Frenchman's duck. Now, withal, time for this grows short. Just outside, in the forest, articulate as drumming, can be heard the rhythmic approach of the cabalistic colossus Mr. Talks has summoned. Mason and Dixon place their heads upon the table, and regard each other solemnly in joint awareness of how much effort will be needed this time to believe Mr. Talks's testimony as to whatever is about to appear. As 'twill prove, the closer they escort Mr. Talks to the metropolis, the less evidence for his creature's existence will they be given, till at length they must believe that the poet has either passed, like some Indian youth at the onset of manhood, under the protection of a potent, though invisible spirit, or gone mad. They leave him upon the Newcastle Road, standing among the late purple loosestrife by the ditch, glancing upward from time to time, waving his arm, then growing still, appearing to listen. Just before he has dwindled around the last bend in their own road, Mason and Dixon see a Conestoga wagon with an exceptionally bright canopy and drawn by matched white horses stop beside him. Timothy Talks without hesitation goes around to the tailgate and climbs up under the luminous canvas, vanishing within, as if confident that the golem, whose strides are at least as long as a team and wagon, will contrive to stay close to him, wherever he is taken, and whatever may befall him there. Chapter 71. Back again, tavern crawling near the wharves upon Delaware, ale stuporous, the surveyors enter the Crooked Finger Inn. We both know what it is, Dixon, Mason is instructing his partner. Your hour is come. Your innings for retributive poultrification. At last you must prepare, mustn't you, for all that expression of Jesuit interest so long deferred. This next commission being, after all, the one they were engineering all along, isn't it? Yes, another degree of latitude to put with the others they've appropriated. This is what it's all been leading to, correct? Wondrous. Now shall you, at least, finally learn, perhaps even via the Jesuit telegraph, why you are here. A blessing extended to how few. Anything I can do to help, of course. But what's the use? The fucking use? Dixon resting his head briefly, though audibly, upon the table. It's over. Naught left to us but paperwork. Their task has shifted from direct traverse upon the line to pen and paper representation of it. In the sober daylight of Philadelphia, strained through 12x12 sash work, as in the specterless light of the candles in their rooms, suffering but the fretful shadows of Dixon at the drafting table, and Mason, seconding now, reading from entries in the field book, as Dixon once minded the clock for him. Finally, one day, Dixon announces, "Well, won't thee at least have a look?" Mason eagerly rushes to inspect the map of the boundaries, almost instantly boggling, for there, bold as a pirate's flag, is an eight-pointed star surmounted by a fleur-de-lis. What's this thing here, pointing north? Wasn't the Legrand flying one of these? Doth it not signify England's most inveterately hated rival, France? All respect, Mason. Among brother and sister needlefolk in every land, 'tis known universally as the fleur-de-lis, a magnetical term. Flower of light. Light, hey? Sounds encyclopedistic to me, perhaps even Masonic, says Mason. A surveyor's north point, Dixon explains, by long tradition is his own, which he may draw and embellish in any way he pleases, so it point where north be. It becomes his hallmark, personal as a silversmith's, representative of his honesty and good name. Further, as with many glyphs, 'tis important ever to keep faith with it, for an often enormous investment of faith and will lies condensed within, giving it a potency in the world that the agents of reason care little for. 'Tis an ancient shape, said to go back to the earliest Italian wind roses, says Dixon. Originally, at the north, they put the letter T for tramontane, the wind that blew down from the Alps. Over the years, as ever befalls such frail bric-a-brac as letters of the alphabet, it was beaten into a kind of spearhead, though the kinder-hearted will aver it a lily and clash thy face do thy deny it. Yet some, finding it upon a new map, might also take it as a reassertion of French claims to Ohio, Mason pretends to remind him. Ah, thou found me out. I confess, 'tis a secret message to all who conspire in the dark. The old Jesuit canard again. At which Armand runs in looking anxious. The duck is doing something autoerotique now. They rephrase. Unconsoled, Armand wanders away. Becoming reaccustomed to this city's angular momentum is costing him daily struggle. He appears to miss the west line, and the duck it is captured and denied him. Perhaps for this map alone, it occurs to Mason, as east and west are of the essence, north need hardly be indicated at all, need it? Or suppose you were to sketch in something less political. This has been my north point, Dixon declares, since the first map I ever drew. I cannot very readily forswear it now, sir, for some temporary tradesman's sign. It does not generally benefit the surveyor to debase the value of his north point by lending it to ends political. It would be to betray my allegiance to Earth's magnetism, Earth herself, if thou like, which my fleur-de-lis stands faithfully as the emblem of. Making no more sense of this than he ever may, Mason shrugs. It may sit less comfortably with the proprietors than with me. Oh, they're as happy to twit a king when they may as the next lad. Ah, so that is it. Thy uncritical worship of kings, with my inflexible hatred of them, taken together, we equal one latter-day English subject. Much more likely twins ever in dispute, as the Indians once told us the beginning of the world. I'm far too jolly a soul ever to fight with thee for long. Because you know how your shins would suffer. Mason is able to inspect the long map, fragrant, elegantly cartouched with Indians and instruments at last. Every place they ran it, every house passed by, road crossed, the ridge lines and creeks, forests and glades, water everywhere, and the dragon nearly visible. So, This is the line as all shall see it after its copperplate morphosis, and all history remember. This is what ye expect me to sign off on? Not the worst I've handed in, and had they wished to pay for coloring, why, that'd scarcely gnaw the place. This is beauteous work. Emerson was right, Jeremiah. You were flying all the time. Dixon, his face darkened by the years of weather, may be allowing himself to blush in safety. Could have us a spot of orpiment all the same. Some lapis? It is possible, here comments the Reverend Cherry Coke, that for some couples, however close, love is simply not in the cards. So must they pursue other projects instead, sometimes together, sometimes apart. I believe now that their third interdiction came when, at the end of the 8-year traverse, Mason and Dixon could not cross the perilous boundaries between themselves. Whatever happened at the Warrior Path, the partners are to remain amicably together among the cheerless bogs of Delaware through nearly another year, busy with the Royal Society's degree of latitude, chaining a meridian over the same ground as the tangent line, shivering in the damp of morning after morning, both fending off the ague with the miraculous willow bark powder discovered by the Reverend Mr. Edmund Stone of Chipping Norton, return to the vegetational horizons, the shumac whose touch brings misery, the deadly water snakes coiled together like the rugi of a single great brain, the gray and even illumination from the sky. Their agreement to uncouple may easily have come, not after all during the crisis of the year before at the Warrior Path, but rather here, somewhere upon this peninsula, wrapped in the lambent passing of any forgotten day of mild winds, the day, as ever, little to distinguish it from others before and after, but the values entered for miles, chains, and links. And why not here, especially with leisure and opportunity at last to talk of plans for the second transit, the possibility of return to America? The story among Dixon's descendants will be that Uncle Jeremiah wished to emigrate and settle here, and that his partner did not. Though in the field book, as late as June 9th, Mason is to be found rhapsodizing in writing about Mr. Twyford's seat upon Nanticoke, as he does throughout the book as to other homes, other rivers, or towns upon them. To Dixon, aye, how pleasing in all ways. Yet address any of it too intently, and like dreams just at the crepuscule, 'twill all vanish unrecoverably. Shakespearean, correct? Nay, transcendence. 'Twas but Masonic. Dixon gazes at the river, the gentle points and coves in the mist, the willows and loblolly pines, desiring, whilst humiliated at how impossible it is to desire any terrain in its interminable unfolding, every last pebble, dip, and rain path. For Mason, the year of Delaware is all passing like a dream. He can believe in this degree they are measuring, but in the way he believes in ghosts. For all its massless suggestion, number is yet more sensible to him than this America that haunts his progress. Stay? Here? Christ, no, Dixon. 'Twas an odyssey. Now must I return to the destiny ever waiting for me, faithfully, her loom now mine to sit and toil at, to the end of days, whilst she's out, no doubt, with any number of suitors, roaring and merry. Well, suggests Uncle Lomax, it's Pope and Lady Montague all over again, isn't it? A touchy race, the Brits, unfathomable, apt to take offense at anything. Disputes can go on for years. Yet 'twas never that cold, declares the Reverend. Each seemed to be content in postponing a return to England, and thereby to what others there expected. Measuring the degree, they may have intended to hide somehow inside the workday, surrendering, as openly as they ever could, into a desire to transcend their differently discomforted lives, through what, at the end of the day, would be but ranks and files of numerals, ever in the darkness of pages unopened and unturned, ink already begun to fade, from type since melted and recast numberless times. All but oblivion, the Delaware country their refuge. No steep grades, as level for 82 miles, they wrote to the Royal Society, as if it had been formed by art, a phrase later to be found in Maskelyne's introduction to their published observations, 1769. No hostile Indians, fresh food, cities in easy reach, obs themselves straightforward and not even all that many, to the world's eye, two veteran wise men, coasting along between transits of Venus, soon to be off again for more glamorous foreign duty, where the seeing's perfect and the food never less than exquisite, and adventures ever ahead and unforeseen, Boscovich and Mayer all over again. A godly pursuit and profitable withal, if only in the value of commissions to come. Yet at the same time, silently parallel to the pleasantries of teamwork, runs their effort to convince themselves that whatever they have left upon the last ridgetop, just above the last stone cairn, as if left burning, as if left exhibited in chains before the contempt of all who pass, will find an end to its torment, and fragment by fragment across the seasons be taken back into the tales preserved in memory, among wind gusts, subterranean fires, over creatures of the wild, floods and freezes, until one day 'twill all be gone, reassumed, only its silence left there to be clamored into by something else, something younger, without memory of or respect for what was once across the third turning of Dunkard Creek brought to a halt. But it does not die. It comes out at nightfall and visits, singly obsessed with a task left undone. Newcomers choose other ridge lines to settle in the shadows of. Indian priests proclaim it forbidden ground, even unto the lead mines beneath. Smugglers of tobacco, dyestuffs, and edged implements flee their storage cabins in the middle of the night, leaving behind inventories whose odd scavengers prove as little able to withstand the disconsolate spirit prevailing here as if 'twere the point upon which was being daily projected some great linear summing of human incompletion. Failed arrivals, departures too soon, misstated intentions, truncations of desire. Even the uncommonly stolid Stig feels it, in his perplexity, resorting more and more often to the handle of his axe for reassurance. Captain Zhang, each night in his tent, shivering, continues to express concern as to the Shaw situation. Returning from here will not be much better. In Shaw, there is no up nor down stream, rather a flow at all points sensible, equally harmful east or west. Our sorrows shall persist and obsess for as long as we continue upon this ill-omened line. Too often, back here, they find themselves chaining through wetlands, the water usually a foot and a half to 2 feet deep. Daylight somewhere above them, indifferent, the gloom in here forcing them to shorter sights, more setups, closer quarters. As they stand in the muck of the cypress swamp, black and thinly crusted, each step breaking through to release a smell of generations of deaths, something in it, some principle of untaught mechanics tugging at their ankles, voiceless, importunate, a moment arrives when one of them smacks his pate for something other than a mosquito. Everywhere they've sent us, the Cape, St. Helena, America, what's the element common to all? Long voyages by sea, replies Mason, blinking in exhaustion by now chronic. Was there anything else? Slaves. Every day at the Cape we lived with slavery in our faces, more of it at St. Helena. And now here we are again in another colony, this time having drawn them a line between their slave keepers and their wage payers, as if doomed to re-encounter through the world this public secret, this shameful core. Pretending it to be ever somewhere else, with the Turks, the Russians, the companies, down there, down where it smells like warm brine and gunpowder fumes, they're murdering and dispossessing thousands untallied, the innocent of the world, passing daily into the hands of slave owners and torturers, but oh, never in Holland, nor in England, that garden of fools. Christ, Mason. Christ what? What did I do? Didn't we take the king's money, as here we're taking it again, whilst slaves waited upon us, and we neither one objected, as little as we have here, in certain houses south of the line? Where does it end? No matter wherein it we go, shall we find all the world tyrants and slaves? America was the one place we should not have found them. Yet we're not slaves, after all. We're hirelings. I don't trust this king, Mason. I don't think anybody else does either. Thus all Lord Ferrers take the drop at Tyburn. They execute their own. What may they be willing to do to us? Chapter 72. First, they have to mark a meridian line, then clear a visto, then measure straight up the middle of it, using levels. Great wooden rectangles, 20 feet long by 4 feet high and an inch thick, mostly of pine boards, with iron and brass securing the reinforcing bands, which would have served handsomely in many of these fens as duckboards or rafts, but must instead be carried carefully upright, being compared most dutifully every day with how close to 8 times a 5-foot brass standard might be fit in the length of the 2 levels set end to end, and into the daily corrections needed, the temperature reckoned and entered as well. Each plumb line is protected from the wind by a 3-foot tube. When tilted until the plumb line bisects a certain point drawn at the bottom, the level is level. It is then necessary only to set it with its mate, together in a 40-foot line easily kept true by sighting down its length toward the farthest point of the visto they can see, on the assumption the visto has been truly made. Back in Durham, we style this a squire's line, using the equipment of the gentleman who hires thee, easy terrain, careful work, turning the telescope over and over, bit of fancy artwork upon the plain table drafts, careful and slow. Slow, 'tis certain. Mason has long dropped all pretense at patience. There are days when the routine has him livid with boredom. As Lady Montague said of Bath, the only thing one can do upon this engagement that one did not do the day before, "Bad luck, don't say it," shouts Dixon through his speaking trumpet, though they are close enough not to require any, causing Mason to wince. Never mind when, shall it end? Set a mark before, set a mark behind. Swing the instrument, do it again the other way. Swuckin' body and blood, Dixon, I am beside myself. Dixon, approaching a few steps, gazes intently a foot and a half to Mason's right. "Hey, why, so he is our. How does thou feel, I wonder?" Switching his eyes to Mason, then back to the spot beside Mason, "Well, why don't one of thee go ahead and the other behind me? Makes it much easier to line up the marks." "Arr, like a giant eye, ever a stare." He is referring to the target, a board about 1 foot square, with concentric circles drawn on both sides, rigged to be slid in 2 grooves at the distant gesturing of the man at the telescope, till it should line up precisely upon the central wire, previously brought into the meridian, whereupon the other surveyor hammers in his stake, immediately below, drops his plummet string along the center line of the target, and marks with a notch exactly where, atop the stake, the bob point touches. Then the transit instrument leapfrogs the target and goes ahead of it. Its operator sets up and takes a back sight at the eye upon the board's reverse. Then they do it all again. "I find little serious astronomy in any of this," Mason complains. It may be the leveled and selfless pulse of it that enables them, at the end of June, the measurement done, at last to travel south together, across the west line, into peril, however differently construed, leading to Baltimore and the moment when Dixon will accost the slave driver in the street and originate the family story whose material focus, for years among the bric-a-brac in Hull, will be the driver's lash that Uncle Jeremiah took away from the scoundrel. "No proof," declares Ives. "No entries for days, allowed, but yet no proof." "Alas," beams the Reverend, "must we place our unqualified faith in the implement as the tale accounting for its presence? These family stories have been perfected in the hellish forge of domestic recension, generation upon generation, till what survives is the pure truth, annealed to mercilessness about each figure, no matter how stretched, nor how influenced over the years by all sentiments, from unreflective love to inflexible dislike. Don't leave out irresponsible embellishment. Rather, part of the common duty of remembering. Surely our sentiments, how we dreamed of and were mistaken in each other, count for at least as much as our poor, cold chronologies. The driver's whip is an evil thing, an expression of ill-feeling worse than any between master and slave, the contempt of the monger of perishable goods for his merchandise, in its tattered braiding, darkened to its lash tips with the sweat and blood of drove after drove of human targets, the metal wires worked into each lash, its purpose purely to express hate with, and hate's corollary, to beg for the same denial of mercy should, one day, the roles be reversed, gambling that they may not be, or that they may. Dixon has spoken with him already, the night before, in the public room of his inn. The slave driver is announcing a vendue at the dock, 20 Africans, men and women, each a flower of the tribe they had been taken from. Yet he is calling them by names more appropriate to animals one has come to dislike. Several times Dixon feels the need, strong as thirst, to get up, walk over to the fellow, and strike him. "And so I hope everyone will come down and have a look. Dusky children of the forest, useful in any number of ways. cook and eat 'em, fuck 'em, or throw 'em to the dogs, as we say in the trade, imagine, gents, your very own darkie to order about as you please. You, sir, in the interesting hat, beckoning to Dixon, who raises his brows amiably, at the same time freezing with the certainty that once again he is about to see a face he knows, someone from the recent past, whose name he cannot remember. A fine young mulatto gal would be just your pint of ale, I'd wager. Well, tonight you're in luck. Damn me if you're not. Not in the market, replies Dixon, as he imagines, kindly. Oh, drawing back in feigned surprise. What's this? Not in the market? How, then, may I even begin to educate you, sir, or should I say friend, upon this topic? The news, friend, being that all are in the market, however regrettably, for everyone wants a slave, at least one, to call his own. Sooner or later, Dixon far too brightly, a slave must kill his master. It is one of the laws of springs. The herdsman of humans who has been staring at Dixon now looks about for a line of withdrawal. Give me engines, for they have no feelings of injustice. Sometimes they don't exist either, so I have to invent what I need. At which point the enterpriser has edged his way as far as the door. Remember, tomorrow, midday at the pier, and he is off like a shot. Attention shifts to Dixon, whose insane demeanor has vanished with the dealer's departure. Will you be there, sir? Inquires a neighboring drinker, more sociably teasing than wishing to sting. Being one of our sights down here, of interest to a visitor, you might find it diverting. Not quite as much as a horse auction, of course. Dixon vibrated his eyeballs for a while. That's it? Slaves and horses? Why, and tobacco? You've never seen a tobacco auction? Say, you'll never listen to an Italian tenor the same way again. In 55, at the grim news of Braddock's fate, Pennsylvanians had come flying eastward before the Indians, over Susquehanna, in a panic. Here in the Chesapeake slave country, rather stretched long nights of apprehension, the counting of kitchen knives, fears concealed, fears detected, fears betrayed, of poisons in the food, stranglings at midnight, women violated, horses and cash, house and home gone, as their spoliators into the boundless continent, and everywhere the soft weight of the nocturnal breath above that water-riddled country.